This is Galesburg's Evening News on WGIL. I'm Will Stevenson. Thanks for joining us tonight. You may have seen a case in the news here in the last day or two that essentially, in one case, the man is charged with murder, and then a grand jury comes in and files a lesser charge of manslaughter. Then the state comes back and files murder charges once again. It's kind of an unusual thing. So I thought we'd use the occasion of that, not the case itself, to kind of talk about the grand jury process and how that works and kind of issues related to that with someone who's been on both sides of it, Attorney Jeremy Carlin, who is with Barash and Everett here downtown these days. Jeremy, thanks for coming in. I appreciate your perspective.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, it's been a little I'll give you the shameless plug here first. It's been a little bit since you guys have moved downtown. How's that worked out for you?
Oh, that's great. I mean, we couldn't be happier with our move. From the fact that we can advertise on Main Street, it's the least expensive advertising that we have. But more importantly for us is that, we can walk over to other attorneys' offices. We can walk to the courthouse. It's convenient for our clients. It's our facility, our space is just excellent, and our landlords have been really wonderful to work with. We are really quite thrilled with the move.
That's great. I'm glad that's worked out for you. And see, some people still want to be on Main Street, so that's a good thing.
Well, you know, you'll find that, and what we found is that with the growth on Main Street, dare I say a renaissance, that downtown space is difficult to find. And I think that's going to happen. I think, wearing a different hat than an attorney, but wearing my city alderman hat.
Wait, you're an alderman too? I hadn't heard anything about that.
I know. I do a lot of things in town. But that you can genuinely feel a shift in the town, that there's been jobs and businesses coming to town, jobs created, an increased energy downtown, and the vibrancy of the community. And I think it's the start of greater things to come, and we're positioned well to take advantage of that.
It certainly is, and you're not the first person I've heard to say that, so that's a good thing. Now let's have you put back on your day job hat,
right,
if you will.
Okay.
You've been on both sides of it. You've been in the state's attorney's office. You've been a defense attorney and that sort of thing. Talk to me first about the grand jury process. What kind of a high-pressure situation, as I'm guessing it is? What kind of a situation is that usually?
Well, you know, and I think it's important to take a step back and talk about, you know, how cases proceed to trial. Felony cases, they're considered more serious, obviously. Mm-hmm. And after there's been an arrest made and charges filed, there needs to be a determination, in essence, a probable cause determination, that the case has sufficient evidence to proceed to trial. And there are two ways of doing it. There's a preliminary hearing in which you present evidence to a judge, mm-hmm. or then there's the grand jury, which you present evidence to 18 citizens, and then they make a determination in grand jury whether or not there's probable cause and whether or not an indictment or a true bill should be handed down. And there are advantages and disadvantages to each process. Which I can talk about.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Leah, why don't we go there
sure.
next?
I mean,
I should back up and say my, covering court cases for as long as I have, my impression of it was always that if you're the state's attorney and you take a case to a grand jury, you've got to be pretty darn sure of what you think is going to happen before you go there. But I'm guessing that's not always the case, is it?
That's not always the case. I mean, of course, a prosecutor has to have the reasonable belief that a crime has been committed and that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it's occurred. I mean, that's the prosecutor's ethical duty. And so naturally, a prosecutor is going to have an idea of how it should proceed. And so when you go to a grand jury, I mean, there are a number of reasons for it to bring a case in front of a grand jury instead of a preliminary hearing. One of them is that a prosecutor has significantly more control over the evidence that's presented to a grand jury, in that there is no defense attorney, there's no judge, there's no opportunity to ask other questions that may assist the defendant. It's the prosecutor, the witness, and the 18 people who are in the grand jury. And so a prosecutor can has significant control within, of course, certain boundaries of truth and honesty and ethics to present the evidence to the grand jury in a manner by which can achieve a certain result. There's a saying in my profession that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. Now, I mean, that doesn't speak to whether or not prosecutors are abusing the system. That's not the case. It's just that there's so much control over the process that they can present the kind of evidence that they want typically to get a particular result.
On the surface, that idea of having all that control could almost seem, I guess, maybe like there's a bit of bias involved. Is there at all? Or it's kind of like, you know, what we're in the media and accused all the time of controlling the facts or controlling what people hear. But, you know, is it like that, or is it more a trial without most of the working parts?
I wouldn't ascribe ill motive to it. It's a situation where you still have people who testify in front of a grand jury, and I've presented to grand juries in my career as a prosecutor. Witnesses are testify under oath. They are typically telling the grand jury what they know to believe to be true. It's typically police officers who have collected evidence. Just in both a preliminary hearing and a grand jury, police officers can testify about what other people told them. So the typical rules of hearsay really don't apply. I think bias is too strong a word, but it is one-sided. Now, there are checks on that.
You are under oath.
You're under oath, as well as that the transcript of the grand jury, there's a transcription that is released to the defense. If there are abuses of the system, that there are means by which to attack an indictment. And that, of course, very rarely occurs that there would even be a motion, let alone something successful like that.
What must from the times where you've presented as a prosecutor to a grand jury, for you as an attorney, what's that like? What's that feeling going through your head when you're doing that?
Well, I mean, you have – that kind of goes to the reasons of why you might want to go to a grand jury instead of a preliminary hearing.
Yeah.
And one, you may not want as a prosecutor, you're trying to guard against undue or inappropriate publicity in a case. A prosecutor seeks to get a fair trial. A prosecutor has the obligation not simply to get convictions, but to do it fairly and appropriately, such that there's no basis for appeal afterwards. And a grand jury offers the opportunity to clear that next procedural hurdle without doing it in a public way. And then there'd be a press report of, well, this is the evidence against, John Smith.
Yeah.
What you're also doing, I mean, there are other reasons to go in front of a grand jury. And one of them is to kind of get a sense of the evidence that you have and how it'll play. Some of these cases, as advocates, we're as guilty as anybody of sometimes having blinders on.
Yeah,
that we kind of a tunnel vision that we see the evidence in a certain way that fits our view of it, because again, we are convinced of the defendant's guilt as a prosecutor, and that you can kind of suffer some tunnel vision. So a grand jury who's just 18 normal people.
That's something that has come up with this most recent case where I've seen people comment that I don't think people realize that when there's a grand jury proceeding. Well, first, I forgot until you said something that it was 18 people and not 12, but that they're just people. They're your neighbors. They're you and me.
They're exactly the case. And so under this current circumstance with Mr. Love, apparently there is perhaps there's an ongoing debate, let's say, or a conversation about what are the appropriate charges. And the state's attorney's office may believe that, and it clearly do, believe that first-degree murder charges are warranted.
Right.
And so I'm making speculations about the evidence that was presented, because these proceedings happen in secret.
Yes.
You don't know when they're not announced. All you know is that there's a closed room in the courthouse and there's a bailiff sitting in front of it. So, or closed courtroom. And you can presume as a person who's done this for a while, okay, that's the grand jury. And, and so, you know, what I presume what happened is that the prosecution presented the evidence in the manner which they believed to be appropriate to obtain the results that they wanted. And then the grand jury looking at the evidence, came up with a different result. And, you know, that sometimes is beneficial. I mean, it's kind of a way to get a sense of what a jury of 12 people in a, with obviously different burdens of proof might, react to that evidence. And again, a prosecutor can choose to take that, in essence, that advice, from a grand jury or proceed differently. And
has it ever happened to you where you presented in front of a grand jury and you didn't get the outcome you thought you might?
No, I can't recall a circumstance where either as a prosecutor, I got a result that, you mean I disagreed with, or that, as a defense attorney, a situation in which a grand jury handed down the indictment and the prosecution said, you know, no, we disagree with that and we're going to proceed in a different way. Mm-hmm. That's what makes the current situation with Mr. Love, the defendant, so uncommon.
Yeah, and I wanted to move on to that next year as we're talking with attorney Jeremy Carlin here on Galesburg's Evening News. In this case, and again, I want to kind of emphasize, other than maybe a few things we've talked about here, my purpose was to not Monday morning quarterback this case, but kind of maybe bring some more understanding to the process as a whole. But in this case, again, there were charges of murder filed. Grand jury instead files charges of manslaughter. So again, the prosecutors again decide to file a new case with murder charges once again attached. How uncommon is that? That the prosecutors, I guess, for lack of a better term, try again when they get this different result from a grand jury?
Well, I've seen it other ways.
Okay.
I've seen it the opposite way, where case has gone to a preliminary hearing in front of a judge, and the judge finds that there's no probable cause and it gets dismissed, and then that the prosecutor then brings it to a grand jury and secures an indictment.
Yes, I haven't seen that too often where a judge doesn't find probable cause, but I imagine that probably happens more than this other situation.
Well, it has happened.
Yeah.
It's not happened to me as a prosecutor. Although, you know, from the bench, the judge will give like a message of, you know, it's only probable cause. You know, if this were proof beyond a reasonable doubt, there might be a different result.
Yeah, I think I've heard that a few times. Yeah,
right. That's a good signal from the bench. It's never happened to me, but I've had cases in which over the years, I've been doing this for practically a quarter century now.
Wow.
I know, right? that you see cases that have been brought before a judge, judge for whatever reason finds that there's no probable cause. And maybe the prosecutor after the fact thinks that maybe I didn't present the case in an appropriate way. I'm going to take another stab of it in front of a grand jury again, in which they have a little more control. It's a new, fresh set of eyes. It's not a defense attorney asking probing questions. And then they're able to secure an indictment. Doing it the other way, which has happened in the case that's been reported in the press recently, where you have a grand jury who hands down a result. The prosecutor, again, for whatever reason, disagrees with the result, decides to then proceed to a preliminary hearing. I've never seen that happen. And that would, you know, you're generally surprised by that type of approach.
What do you think could lead to that? Pressure from perhaps the family of a victim, maybe a political type situation?
Well, you know,
what do you think could happen there?
Any number of things. Mm-hmm. And not knowing the details of the case other than what's been reported by this radio station and other local media outlets, I mean, it's hard to know exactly. It could be, again, a situation where the prosecutor after the grand jury presentation and the handing down of a true bill and no true bill on murder, realized that perhaps they left something out and that with a different presentation, they get a different result. It could be political pressure. It could be a victim's families or other individuals calling into the state's attorney's office demanding a certain result. And, you know, state's attorney's office, like any other elected official, is susceptible to political pressure. We'd like to think not. And frankly, the grand jury system is designed for a way to prosecutors to minimize that type of political pressure. Mm-hmm. A prosecutor can say, you know, it's not me making the decision about how the charges proceed, but I've given all the appropriate evidence to citizens like you who have reviewed it and decided this is the means by which to proceed. And it gives prosecutors cover, I think, and a sense of, again, how it proceed. So it could be that. It could just genuinely be the good faith belief by the prosecutor that a different prosecutorial charge is more appropriate. Mm-hmm. And kind of substituting their own judgment for that of the grand jury. I mean, it could be any number of things.
In terms of the trial clock, as I always hear it talked about in terms of getting a speedy trial out, what kind of an impact can there be on that? Because, and I'm thinking, especially in this case, tomorrow morning, Mr. Love will appear before a judge again, basically on this for the same reason he just appeared in front of a judge. Does that kind of back up the clock, or does it keep the clock going forward? How impacted can a victim's rights to a fair trial be in a situation like this?
I mean, there's a victim's rights to fair trial, but you're talking about the defendant here.
Yes, that's what I mean. I'm sorry.
I mean, there are both things. I mean, there's a victim's bill of rights. But under these circumstances, given the fact that if there is any delay, and there may not be really any significant delay for individuals in custody, I frankly don't know if Mr. Love's in custody
or
not.
He is not.
Well, he's not. So then, they have 160 days to bring this to trial from the date of the demand for speedy trial. And, you know, whether or not his attorneys have filed a demand for speedy trial, there are tactical reasons to do that or not. Sometimes you don't want that kind of pressure because you want all the time in which to prepare a defense. Sometimes you believe that it's appropriate to file that demand because you want to keep it all under the gun. And it kind of does put the prosecution under pressure. Under these circumstances, either way, if there is any delay, I can't imagine that it's attributable to the defendant. And there would be an argument that that the clock started ticking when he was arrested initially.
Right.
And not that it restarted somehow.
And I should kind of back up here too again and say, you know, I think I sometimes tell people when I hear somebody say, "Oh, he's guilty. We all know he's guilty. We should throw the book at him." I tend to say to people, "Look, if you were arrested for any crime, you would want the same rights afforded to you." And I don't think people realize that there are, as we said, rights on both sides of it here.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. I mean, that it's important to recognize that. You know, it's easy to kind of rush to an opinion or rush to a conclusion after reading certain things in the newspaper. And try as you may and as the Register Mail may do, they are not perfect, and sometimes they get it wrong. Sometimes they aren't given the whole story, and so it's hard for them to give a complete picture. So you can't really rush to a conclusion of guilt based on what you read in the newspaper. But Will, I think more – to the point is that, you know, it's easy to kind of say these things in the abstract about other people. But when, you know, it is amazing, I have found over the years that when the shoe's on the other foot, it's a family member who's accused of a crime, it's themselves accused of a crime that they did not commit, how people really do want a complete process. And so I think it's kind of a situation where, you know, it would just counsel on people to say and encourage people to take the position of, you know, just as if it were your own loved one, you know, this person's a member of our community. Mm-hmm. He deserves all of the protections and the presumptions that the criminal justice system provides before we to rush to guilt.
In 30 seconds, before I completely run out of time here, Jeremy, do you think, as maybe sometimes I do, that the more, especially with social media these days, people comment on cases before they're resolved or as the process goes on, or, you know, when somebody doesn't understand that an arraignment, chances are a defendant is going to plead not guilty, whether you want them to or not. Does that affect how fair of a trial somebody can get here? I guess I see this at some point leading to in a broad sense, and to many more change of venue requests for any type of case than, you know, we've seen in the past.
I know it's hard to know the full effect that social media will have on our cases. I think people like you and I who keep abreast of the case the cases that happen in our courtrooms, mm-hmm. who also then read the media, social media opinions, perhaps of the articles that you post, have a better sense of the opinions that are out there. I think most people don't, they go about their day and they don't think about it the way that perhaps you and I would. Nonetheless, also, I mean, I think, you know, what social media provides is it doesn't, it allows people to react without without being able to think about it first, without being circumspect. And so, you know, so before social media, you know, if people really had a strong opinion, they'd maybe write a letter to the editor. But that takes some time to compose that.
Or they call into the radio station and try to express their opinion.
But regardless, it requires them to take 30 seconds to say, hey, okay, do I really think that, or is that appropriate? Where, you know, dropping a note on Facebook or Twitter doesn't require that filter. So, you know, that's why often in my business, when I'm talking to people, that I say that, you know, people's first reaction often isn't their best or their last. If people are given an opportunity to think about it for a moment, and think about whether or not they'd want those print comments printed on the cover or the Register Mail or let off at the 6 o'clock morning news, mm-hmm. with, you know, Johnny625 says that, I think they would perhaps think differently about what they said. But, you know, that's the thing about the internet, which is that you get this thing before you know how to really use it ethically.
Yeah.
And then it's the, you know, eventually over time, we're going to figure that out.
Yeah. I think we're all guilty of that more often than we would ever confess to in a court of law, ironically. So
that's right.
There you go. All right. Real quickly, how can folks get a hold of your office?
Oh, sure. We are at 143 East Main Street. We are a county seat practice, so we practically handle anything you'd want. You can call us at 341-6010. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeremy Carlin. One of these days we'll have you back to talk about city issues as an alderman and not as legal issues. But you're a darn fine legal mind, and I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Kim Commando and Sports is next on Galesburg's Evening News at WGIL.